It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. And of course, if this is your first time listening or you just recently started listening to us, thanks very much for that. As you know, we're on Instagram, and as our book club is coming up, we wanted to tell you a bit about it. We're going to be discussing Claire Keegan's latest story, which is called So Late in the Day. And you can send us voice notes via Instagram if you like, or even old school messages to let us know what you think about the book, or indeed about anything else you'd like us to cover on the podcast. We'd love to hear from you. My guest today is an urban culture trying to make the world a better place, one tree at a time.
The trees arrived in bags, so 13,000 trees fit in a white van. You know, they're tiny, they're sticks in a bag. They have no leaves on them apart from the Scots pines, obviously have their little needles on them, but everything else is just like dead sticks. And you go out, I went down on actually around about Easter time to do my first thinking, you know, I'd heard tell that foresters and people who are used to it can plant thousands of trees in a day. And I thought, let's see how many I can plant in a day. And I started, and I think I got maybe 300 or 400 planted, which is a huge amount of trees, but I have never been as tired.
That was the voice of Catherine Cleary there, and she's going to be telling us how she came to buy land in Roscommon, where so far she has planted 24,000 trees with a little help from her friends.
I get hope from working with trees and soil because I can see the absolute health and vigour and life force of things that, you know, when you're in the flow with this, it's fixing itself. You take one good step and nature takes 10.
Before we talk to Catherine, one story that caught her eye is the fact that standalone criminal offences for stalking and non-fatal strangulation, as well as longer maximum prison sentences for assaults, came into effect from today. And this is from a story by Jack Power in the Irish Times. The maximum sentence for assault causing harm, which is common in cases of domestic abuse, has also been doubled from 5 to 10 years, which is good news. And the existing offence of harassment has been broadened to include cases where someone seriously interferes with an individual's peace or privacy in a way that causes distress or harm. New standalone offences for stalking and non-fatal strangulation, which could previously be charged under different offences, are among the changes in the new law. And the new offence for stalking, and we're kind of surprised that there hasn't been an actual offence for just stalking on its own, but this new offence for stalking will carry a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison, while non-fatal strangulation or suffocation will have a maximum sentence of 10 years, rising up to life imprisonment if the incident causes serious harm. So those are some positive developments, because as we know, most of the victims of stalking would be women. So this is positive news in that regard. Now, my guest today is, full disclosure, a good friend of mine, but she's also a source of great inspiration to many, because in the last few years, she's embarked on a truly wonderful project, which she wrote about recently in the Irish Times. And I'd urge you to look up that article. Wanting to do their bit for the planet and the biodiversity crisis, Catherine Cleary and her husband Liam bought 40 acres of cheapish land in Roscommon with a view to planting 11 hectares, a forest bigger than St. Stephen's Green. And they now have a thriving, if small, forest and lots of other land that has sprung to life and made a home at various stages to a cuckoo, countless frogs, field mice, hares, foxes, birds, mewling buzzards, murmurations of starlings, and even the rare sighting of a barn owl or two. Working with a forester, Bernard Kiernan, they purchased the land 3 years ago, and the first batch of trees arrived on Catherine's birthday this year, at the end of March. The load of 13,000 bare root trees in bags was small enough to fit in a single white van. The planting was difficult and stressful and had to be done by hand, boot and spade, but they had a lot of help from friends and family. and eventually planting contractors. According to the carbon calculators, Catherine's forest should begin to sequester significant amounts of carbon in about a decade. And she says forestry needs to become as sexy a job as chefing, something both women and men see as a tough but desirable and satisfying career. So here she is, Catherine Cleary, or Farmer Cleary, as I call her. Catherine, tell us how you went from crime to food to forests.
From murders to meringues to maples. No, actually, we didn't plant any maples.
Very well done.
God, that's a good opening question, isn't it? Yeah, I was a hard-nosed, hard-bitten crime journalist back in the 90s here in this very building. No, not in this very building, in the old Irish Times building.
Drugs and crime correspondent.
Drugs and crime correspondent, yeah, in the 90s. I was just talking about it recently to somebody because I got an email out of the blue from a journalist researching something, and he dug up out of the ancient history a piece that I had written about a Dublin criminal. And it read like something that somebody else had written, because it feels like another lifetime ago that I was doing that kind of work. But it was fascinating. I mean, you really get to understand how society works. You understand the huge social problems that cause drug and crime, and how solving those social problems is a big fix for that whole area.
And we won't labour too much on it, but at the time, was it unusual for a woman to be a crime correspondent? Obviously, Veronica Guerin had been doing a lot of investigations and stuff, but it still is to an extent, a male-dominated area.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the areas I was reporting on in the 90s were very male-dominated. You know, I was on a particular press trip where I was the only woman on the plane. and at that time, it felt... You just felt you got on with it. You know, you put up with the comments and the assumptions that you were getting stories because you had certain relationships with people. You know, it was pretty toxic now looking back on it. Yeah, I realized
that. But normalised in your head, this was just part of the cut and thrust of daily
absolutely.
Life.
Yeah, it was how you had to roll, and you rolled with it. Yeah. But I mean, Veronica she ploughed a furrow for women journalists, and they've been brilliant women crime journalists again. And they take an interest in, you know, male crime journalists do as well, but I think there's an interest there in the bigger picture of it as well. So okay. it's a good aspect to bring to it.
And from the crime to going to restaurants, fancy restaurants sometimes, and, you know, critiquing them for the Irish Times.
Yeah, that was my segue into food was 21 years ago nearly, when my eldest son was born, and Lee's Hand, who was editing the Tribune magazine at the time, said, "You're the only one in the Tribune newsroom who knows how to cook." And I was. They were shocked. They were shocking. They lived on Toner's curry and ready meals. So she said, "Would you do a cookery column?" The bar was very low at that stage. And I thought about it and thought, God, you know, having been in that male-dominated, hard-nosed, you know, therefore status world of journalism, it was a real sidestep to go into the women's world of cooking.
Back into the kitchen.
Get yourself back into the kitchen now with your notions of being a crime journalist. So, but at the time, I was living in Wicklow. My old school, the Dominican in Wicklow Town, had turned their beautiful, very, expensive land into an organic farm. And that was a real eye-opener for me. I suddenly realised, oh, there are seasons and things grow at a time of year. And, you know, I realised there's never not going to be something to write about in food and farming and agriculture. So I wrote a cookery column for, I think, 2 or 3 years in the Sunday Tribune. Yeah, there's some archive somewhere with it sitting there. My mother's bolognese recipe, I think, was one of the first ones that I pulled out of the bag. And then Patsy Murphy, the former editor of the magazine in the Irish Times, emailed me at one point and said, would I take on the Irish Times restaurant column for a spell? So I said, yes, please.
They always say for a spell, and then you end up there for many, many years.
Yeah, I did actually in the end, yeah.
But I think the food thing, funnily enough, there's a really clear thread from that, isn't there, to where you are now and to what we're going to be talking about today, because you mentioned that, realising seasons, agriculture, farming, all that kind of stuff. And it's like it lit anyway, maybe a very small flame, but some kind of a flame in you that is now blazing today.
Yeah, I mean, you very quickly, when you start writing about food, and I was writing features as well as the restaurant column, and seeing this kind of huge pride in chefs and in producers about what we could produce on this island. You know, we have an amazing climate for growing things. And you could suddenly see that there is a really interesting story here. There's an interesting story about power and control and who controls the land and who decides what's grown on it. There's an interesting story about women in kitchens as well. You know, that was part of the scene that was evolving when I was working in the restaurant area. I did an event back in 2018, I think, called the Appetite Talks, which was based around that idea of where our food culture was going. You know, we had this very high-end restaurant culture, which was growing, which was fantastic, you know, celebrating talents and ingredients. And then at the other end, we had this very intensive agricultural system really ramping up, especially during the recession, and becoming a huge force in the country and a huge lobbying power as well. So that was really interesting to see. And it all goes back to, what are we doing with the natural world? You know, are we extracting things from it, or are we going with the flow and making sure that it's going to be there for the next generation?
Because I think you've always been very political in a small P sometimes and a bigger P in other times. And I remember years ago talking to you about possibly getting into politics, and maybe that was your contribution. That didn't actually happen in the end.
Yeah, I mean, 2018 was the IPCC report, which told us in, you know, very frightening language that we had 12 years. And that really hit me. I mean, I burst into tears when I read the reports of that report. Because I'd been in the space of trying to, you know, writing about transport, writing about retrofitting our house, moving back to the city because we didn't want to commute, you know, all of those things that I could see would make people's lives better and would also give us a better chance at, you know, tackling climate change, because it was very obvious to me that this was a massive problem, despite all the denial, which we now know was funded by fossil fuel companies. You know, there's been an incredibly damaging delay, which was very deliberate. So, yeah, I did think in 2018, how can I use my voice? How can I do something? I did think, God, will I stand for some kind of political office? But actually, I physically couldn't. My head couldn't even get around that idea. You know, I have huge admiration for anybody in politics at the moment, especially somebody who's there to try and make things better, because it's not an arena that I could enter.
But to another P then, pocket forests. So yeah. Again, which is political, because I think everything is when you're trying to make a change in the world and make things better. Tell us about pocket forests and how you came up with that with your friend.
Yeah, so 2020 came, and as we know, the world shut down, and we were, my good friend Ash Conrad-Jones, we live 3 streets away from each other, our kids are in school together, and we were suddenly locked down in our 2K zone, which was very, very suffocating, I think, for its lack of green space. That spring was happening, and she came across this idea. She loves all things tiny, tiny donkeys, tiny dogs, ponies, and her partner sent her this piece about tiny forests, and we both looked at this and said, this is incredible. This is such an amazing idea. It started in the 1970s with a Japanese botanist. He was still alive at the time. He died only just last year. And he loved, Japan is very forested, but it's also very urban. And he loved forests, and he loved the idea of being able to bring them into urban areas. So he looked at the components of a forest, you know, these tall trees, smaller trees, shrubs and ground cover. And he came up with an idea to plant them in really tiny areas. You know, they are very tiny. And it just seemed like such a great fix for our part of the city, where our green spaces were being chewed up all the time. We've student housing been built all around us, you know, thousands and thousands of new people coming into the area.
This is Dublin 8.
In Dublin 8, yeah. And less.
Very trendy Dublin 8, I might say.
It is now, yeah. But it's where my grandmother, my great grandparents grew, were there. You know, I have a huge love for the area. But at the same time, it's becoming very, very intense place to live because of the intensity of housing, which is great. You know, that close to the city, you do need to have 7 stories and all those kinds of things, but you also need to have intense green spaces. And that's what this model seemed like. So our first kind of step into it was to see, is anybody doing this in Dublin? Can we get in touch with them and say, can you put one in our neighbourhood? And then we found out, no, there isn't anybody doing it in Dublin.
And was it, just to say back to that guy in Japan, is it?
Or yes. Yeah.
Did he have a thing called pocket forests, or did he?
No, so he had worked in India with an Indian car engineer called Shubhendu Sharma doing a pocket forest outside a Toyota factory. And Shubhendu, being an engineer, loved this and then put together a process for doing it. And he called it tiny forests.
Okay.
So Shubhendu had come to the Netherlands in 2015 with his idea. They had grown one in Europe, showing that it's perfectly suitable for European conditions as well. And then we spoke to the group in the Netherlands that were doing it to find out how they went about doing it, what reaction they were getting to it. And the more and more, the more we talked to people, and actually Dan from IVN, the Dutch group, was just so generous with his time. You know, we were all at home in our Zoom screens talking to each other. And he said, look, I knew nothing about forests 5 years ago, but this has been one of the best projects we've ever taken on. And, you know, if we think we're tight for space in Dublin 8, in the Netherlands, it's even worse. You know, it's a tiny country with 19 million people. Every square inch of ground is battled over. So they were finding that this model worked really well. The really exciting thing was that people get to build these forests themselves in their urban areas. It's not something that landscapers come in and do. So with that, we said, right, well, let's try and learn as much as we can about this and come up with our own version of it. We called it pocket forest because the tiny forest idea involves a lot of heavy machinery coming in and digging out a meter of soil. We didn't really see that as being something we might. One day I might drive a digger, but no, I don't.
I have no doubt, Catherine. No doubt at all. Come on.
But, not, an electric,
but not
today.
Digger if they exist.
And also they were doing a tiny, tiny garden version of it. Tuni is the Dutch word for garden. So they were riffing on that, calling it Tuni Forest. And Dan kind of in passing said, oh, and some of our garden forests are doing really well and we don't dig out a meter of soil. So that kind of piqued our interest and we said, oh, so you can put these in really small spaces. We looked at, he was generous enough to share the nursery list of species that they were planting, very similar to, you know, a lot of the same native Irish species are native to the Netherlands as well. So it was just really exciting. Yes, this can be done and let's give it a go.
So did it start in the pandemic then, your first pre-planting?
Yeah, so we went about 2020, we started researching, we did a plot in Mercy Secondary School in Inchicore was our first
Love
one.
Love that school, we've had the Mercy girls on this school. Podcast.
Brilliant school. Michelle, the principal, was just so open to the idea. The girls were delighted with the chance to go and dig up the lawn and start, you know, bring it in. We had donkey manure and we had a lot of fun doing that. And they were hugely involved in designing it and figuring out where it is. And you can now see it on Google Maps. It's this lovely circular forest where they sit in there when there's, you know, too much going on at playtime or, you know, it's now a mixed school as well. So there's a lot of football going on. So for a quieter space, they've got this pocket forest. They have an outdoor classroom. And we got a text from one of the teachers the other day just saying the window was open and she could just hear birds singing and dancing around in the pocket forest. So that's, yeah, our work is very, very satisfying when you get texts like that back.
That's brilliant. But you didn't stop with the pocket forest and you were doing them all around the city and people can get in touch. I'm going to talk a bit more about it later. But so how did you get from there to the sort of dream of really expanding it? I want my own big piece of land where I can plant many, many more trees. Because like you told me this, we're friends and you told me, I remember we were sitting at a dinner table and I just couldn't get over it that you had gone and bought this land and what you were doing. So tell everyone how you grew from Pocket Forest to this other project.
Yeah, niggling at the back of my head, back in 2019, I had gone to a 2-day native woodlands training course. And I kind of sat in the room not really knowing why I was there. I wasn't there as a journalist. It was mainly landowners and foresters and ecologists who were in the room. And it was fascinating. Declan Little, who's the man, he's one of the leading experts in native woodlands. He was the man who was behind that genius idea back in the millennium where they gave us all a native tree. You know, we got a candle and we got a tree and a certificate number. So I'd always kept in touch with him and always been fascinated by it. And day one of the conference was a lot of PowerPoint, very interesting. But it was PowerPoint. But day two was a trip to a forest nearby in Enniskerry. And it was, there were some old oak trees that had begun to seed themselves because they'd deer fenced, they kept the deer out and they'd planted new trees. And I stood in this dripping, wet, mossy oak forest and something just shifted in me. And I thought, I really want a piece of this. I just thought it was an incredible place to be. And I'd never been anywhere like it before. And there are so few fragments of it left. So,
and was it the fact that the oaks were seeding and then through those seeds were building new trees? Was that kind of almost emotional for you, it feels like?
Very much, yeah. And very much that feeling. And I think there's good science about all of the chemicals that are in the air and how we are, when we are standing in those amazing places, how good we feel in them. You know, it's very woo-woo, as Ash always says. But, you know, it's also science. We are, our bones know that we're safe there. We're safe in forests. You know, our ancestors found their food and shelter and clean water there. So it makes sense that we have this enormous connection. It's not, you know, the membrane isn't that thick between that time when places like that were places of places that we felt were sacred. You know, we had all kinds of spirits. Trees were felt to have their own spirits. Moncon has written beautifully about this as well. Trees, rivers, all of the natural world, because we were so interconnected with it, so dependent on it. You know, we don't need to depend on that. And that's great freedom for most people. Most people love, I mean, I love the fact I don't have to go out and look in a field for my breakfast. You know, it's great to be in a modern, comfortable life. But there's something there that we need to keep connected to as well.
So that lit the sort of spark and you went off looking. Did it take much persuading, your husband Liam? Was he on board from the beginning?
It was funny. I think it was a COVID thing. We both felt that sort of, I mean, because we'd kind of both run away from rural Ireland.
You call yourself urban cultures.
Urban cultures, very much urban cultures, you know.
Urban boggers.
boggers to the core. Although he's more of a Midlands bogger. I was more of an East Coast bogger. And I mean, we kind of ran away that, you know, our lives were urban. We wanted to be in cities. We love the city. But, I mean, initially we looked at much smaller plots of land. We weren't going to go anywhere near what we eventually did. But we just thought, now's the chance. Let's see if we can buy something, see if we can get the native woodland license to plant and go from there. So it was very much, let's see if we can do this at the start.
And was it difficult to find land in the right price, at the right place? I suppose the main thing was you wanted to plant loads of trees, so the land had to be able to support that.
Yeah. So we needed to go somewhere that the land was very cheap, and that meant it was going to be very rough, you know, flooded, probably over-farmed, over-grazed land that nobody really wanted. It's very hard to get land. I mean, we came close to buying or looked, we made offers on about three places in the end. One of them, it was kind of Father Ted-ish. It had been owned, the estate agent who was kind of at the end of his tether at that point. It was owned by two priests. One of them wanted to sell, the other one didn't. I think we'd offered near the asking price, and then they took it off the market and put it back on for way more money in the end. So yeah, there's all kinds of difficulties out there. And I don't think it's gotten any easier to buy land. Eventually what we bought is not all in one holding. One area is about a mile from another area. But actually, that suits what we're doing, because hopefully it will extend the habitat. There's lots of good hedgerows between our patches of forest that are around this area. I think it would very easily have been sold in separate lots, but the owner wanted to sell it in one lot. So we were the only buyer for it, really. But the sale fell through at one point and we went looking again, and then the owner came back. So yeah, you're on. So it took, I'd say, about a year to find somewhere.
Okay. And tell everyone where it is and where, what exactly.
It's in Roscommon, rural Roscommon. Yeah. Very nice part of the world.
Where's the nearest place you can get a train to?
You can get a train to Carrick and Shannon. It's probably the nearest spot. And so we're about an hour from the Atlantic as well. I mean, the dream would have been to find somewhere beside the sea, but you know, the money wasn't going to stretch to that. So it was, it's the part of the country I didn't know very well, but we've found the neighbours have been very welcoming, very happy to see us coming. And, you know, I tell them, yes, we're planting trees, but it's not Sitka.
Well, tell everyone why it's not Sitka and why that's relevant.
Yeah, and it's funny, I've been looking at the Sitka thing. I've been in two Sitka forests in the last 2 weeks and just trying to learn about some of that as well. And there is a very interesting issue there that, you know, Sitka isn't kind of demonized, but actually it's an amazing building material, and we do need to build houses. And if we can build in wood, then there's a lot of ways to do that. And there's a way to farm Sitka, because that's really what you're doing. You're farming trees rather than foresting them. There is a way to farm them that's much less environmentally damaging than the way that has been done recently. But these are, yeah, we have Scots pine. They're the only conifer because they're native Irish. So we're growing native Irish trees, which will be light-leaved. You know, they're not that very, very dark sort of corridors of Sitka that we see. And Sitka itself isn't like that. If it's let grown without the tight spacing, and if it's let grown for longer, it's a beautiful tree. Mm. But we grow it as a crop. So, you know, I think that makes people feel, I'm going to lose that sense of land being there. It's just going to disappear under this monoculture of these lines of very dark trees. And people feel quite vociferous about, I don't want land swallowed up by that.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? and some, well, less awesome. Like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Going back to your land, which is not going to be a Sitka. There's no Sitkas. Is there even one? No.
There isn't. Although now that I'm thinking about it, there might be. Okay. I might put a few in there.
A little pocket Sitka forest, maybe see and do properly. But you needed a consultant. You need someone all the time with you, a forester. Tell us about the process.
Yeah. So to access the grant, which is the government money that it pays to set up the forest and then pays you a premium, or I said I wasn't going to use the word premium. It's such a farmery word. It gives you an annual payment to keep the trees in good order. You have to work with the forester and you have to get a license from the Department of Agriculture. And for a long time, the licenses were being held up, partly because people were challenging licenses for Sitka or for felling Sitka. And it meant that the whole system got backed up very severely. So you could be waiting years for your license to plant what could help with our climate and biodiversity crisis. So they made a big push within the department to move things along. But you still have to work with a forester and with a license to do this if you want to access the grants. You can plant trees without accessing a grant, but to get the money, you need to go through these hoops.
Mm. So what did he help you with? And what was your vision? Like, did you have a very clear vision for what you wanted to do?
Yeah, I mean, the vision was let's plant for climate and biodiversity. Let's try and get these trees into the ground. It's also a way of, I suppose, regenerating that land, because there are old, we found one ancient stump of a really, really old Scots pine that was obviously cut down from the land, and there's no Scots pine there now. So it's about bringing back those habitats into that part of the country and then improving the land with trees. We had a great visit a couple of days ago to somebody who's 20 years further down the line than we are with this and has planted native woodlands. So it was wonderful to see their native woodlands, see what they're doing with it, how they're managing it, what it looks like, even that exciting thing of, wow, this is how big they're going to get in 20 years. So the vision is going to evolve, I think, as to what it's going to be and how we're going to use it and what we're going to, you know, what we're going to make from it. But that's kind of exciting as well, because I think the whole forestry field in Ireland is at that stage as well. People are realizing, as Sean, the owner of this wonderful forest that we visited, was saying, this is one of the best countries in the world to grow trees. You know, we have
best little country in the world to grow trees.
Best little country in the world to grow trees. We have an incredible growing season, you know, despite all of the difficult growing conditions for other crops this year. Trees have been growing like topsy, leaping out of the ground, as somebody said to me.
You wrote a beautiful piece recently in the Irish Times, sort of detailing what it's been like. The first trees arrived on your birthday, I think, in March this year. So, I mean, it's backbreaking work, but very satisfying, as you said earlier. Yeah. Tell us about this time and how many trees you've planted and who you've, because I haven't been down there to see it, but it sounds amazing.
You will be soon, right?
Yeah, I know. I'm dying to.
Bring your shovel.
Yes.
And somebody emailed saying, you should point out the people don't have to plant them themselves. So people don't have to plant them themselves. A forestry company We wanted to, and also at the time that we were doing it, there was a shortage of labour that was available in our part of the country. So the trees arrived in bags. So 13,000 trees fit in a white van. You know, they're tiny. They're sticks in a bag. They have no leaves on them, apart from the Scots pines obviously have their little needles on them, but everything else is just like dead sticks. And there are thousands and thousands of them, and they'll last in the bags for a couple of weeks, or, you know.
But you have to get them in the ground.
But you have to get them in the ground.
It's sort of a deadline. I know you're used to deadlines, but this was urgent.
It's a very real deadline, lots of dead trees deadline. And they started leafing up in the bags as well. Like, the hazels began to push out these leaves, and, you know, you're kind of thinking, oh my God, how are they even doing that? There's no soil on, you know, just what they came out of the nursery. And so the life force was brilliant. And you go out. I went down on actually around about Easter time to do my first, thinking, you know, I'd heard tell that foresters and people who are used to it can plant thousands of trees in a day. And I thought, let's see how many I can plant in a day. And I started, and I think I got maybe 300 or 400 planted, which is a huge amount of trees, but I have never been as tired. And
how long did that take, all day?
That was hours of work. Yeah, that was just hours with a podcast or an audiobook. And, you know, you're on your own in a field dealing with this very, very wet, heavy soil and trees with different root systems. You're putting a spade in the ground, opening up a slot, putting the bare root tree into it and pressing it down or booting it in, depending on how patient you're feeling, and then walking on to the next one. So it's amazing work. It was, you know, you don't want to romanticize manual labor because I'm doing it from a very privileged position. I'm not trying to make a living from this. Yeah. So, you know, it's me dropping into this world, but it's incredible, and it gives me huge respect for people who do that work and who are so badly paid for it as well, because it is hugely important work and we don't pay people enough to do it. You know, the team who eventually arrived were astonishing. They could plant a tree in about 3 or 4 seconds and then move on to the next one. And they planted 18,000, there were the other 18,000. So between us, we had some family over for Easter. We had a barbecue, said, come and plant trees. we had lots of family come and help. And we, between all of that and Bernard the Forester, we planted about 6,000 trees. And then the team came and planted the other 18,000.
So you've around 25,000
trees. 24,000 trees,
24,000.
Yeah.
Yeah, my maths not very good. and tell us about what it is like now, sort of versus when, I mean, I know it's very early stages in terms of your forest, but presumably the environment and the biodiversity and all of those things, as you write so beautifully about in the Irish Times, has been transformed.
Yeah, and there was a lot there already.
Already, yeah.
I mean, that was the thing. Because we didn't have animals grazing it for a year, you could see this just coming to life in a way that if the grass hadn't got very tall, there wouldn't be as many, I mean, spiders like I've never seen before, just literally filtering the midges out of the air, because it's real midge country as well. And you realise there are fewer midges because there are millions of spiders and they're making these webs between the rushes and filtering, like each web would have maybe 50 midges in it. So, you know, there's all of that. There's the bird life is astonishing. I need to download an app where I can identify these birds,
yeah,
and know what are there. We can see buzzards. We've seen buzzards coming over. We've seen a barn owl twice, which was just magical.
Because they are rare.
They are rare,
right?
And they're rare in the West as well. So, yeah, there is, you know, everything we can do to make habitat for those creatures who belong there. I mean, we work visitors most of the time. We go down and we're not really, it's a weird idea to feel like you own something like this, because you can see everything that's there that's making use of it so much more than you are. It's so wet that there are many, many frogs and toads as well. Like planting, sometimes something would hop and it would be a small frog.
And is there any like pondy bits or, you know, very wet parts?
There will be. We have areas that we haven't planted, so we're hoping to do some ponds there and, yeah, make habitat for all those frogs that will move out of the forest area.
And there
when
is
it dries
a dwelling
out
on the land, but it's not exactly she.
Yeah, it's it's an old cottage that we may be able to do something with at some point, but
do you stay there when you go
we
down?
Camp, yeah, we have a tent and a campfire, and yeah, we've put a floor into a shed, so there's somewhere dry and clean to be when it's raining, because it's pretty much raining all the time. and we've camped in dry weather, which hasn't been very often this year, so yeah, it'll be nice to pace ourselves
tell us about the you talked about the premium. We didn't want to get too much into farmer talk, but there is a sort of a, for other people listening who might be inspired, how does it work financially?
Yeah, so you get a grant per hectare to.
And how many hectares do you have?
So we have 11 hectares planted. We have, I think, in acres for the, we have 40 acres in total. So we've planted 27 of that, which is 11 hectares, and then the remainder, the 13 acres, is not planted. So the establishment grant pays for the fencing and for the machinery to come in and prepare the land and for the trees and for the planting of them. That goes through the forester who accesses that grant. And then we get a payment. The payment was increased from 600 per hectare per year. Previously, under the new forestry programme, it's up to 1,100. So it's nearly doubled for native woodlands. So the money is much more generous. If you're a farmer, you get it for 20 years. We, as landowners, we only get it for 15 years. And after that, if you were growing a Sitka crop or a timber crop, you would grow it on for another 10 or 15 years and then harvest it. And that's where your payment comes. The thing that I think that puts some farmers and landowners off is that you then have a legal requirement to keep the trees there. You have to replant it with forestry. So it's permanently forestry land if you access it.
Which is brilliant, plants. But I suppose, yeah. Like you're saying, it makes people feel like it's too much of a commitment or...
Yeah, there's a cultural issue around whether your land is forestry or farming, because typically forestry land was much lower value and farming land was much more valued. There's a lovely mix of the two. I'm involved with the Irish Agroforestry Forum and they've got really good examples of how you can put trees on your land and still farm it. And you have huge benefits by doing that. The trees can improve your soil. The animals love them. They're almost like outdoor sheds for animals. There's a brilliant farmer, Clive Bright, in Sligo, who's doing that with his land. And he's hoping to have his herd entirely outdoors 12 months of the year, which is really, really beneficial environmentally, because you're not having this massive buildup of slurry from having indoor housed animals, which then can cause problems with water and also is a greenhouse gas, source of greenhouse gases. So those kinds of, I suppose, more in tune with nature farming models are there, but there's still a resistance, I think, to see forestry as, there's less pride in being a forester, I think, than there is in being a farmer. It's strange. And I think hopefully that's something that this new generation of foresters coming out can bring back into it.
And talking about, you said you're not making a living, but like if someone wanted to try and do what you did, I know land is more expensive now than it was even when you bought it, but people could get a loan, they could buy things, and then the loan could quite quickly be repaid because of all these payments?
Yeah, I mean, if you're buying land at a certain price, I can't remember, somebody worked it out, but if you're buying it at the average price for what they call marginal land, you know, the payments will pay for that land over time. And then you have a forest that you can get income from, whether it's from, initially it would be firewood and things like that. But then hopefully there will be a whole industry of makers, crafters who can use timber from native trees, as well as, you know, and again, you can have a Sitka element on your farm, which can be much more lucrative as well, because it's great building timber.
But we haven't talked about the actual trees that are on it. You mentioned hazel. You mentioned a couple more. Tell us all the different trees that have been planted.
Yeah, so we planted both kinds of oak, both Irish oak, sessile and pedunculate. We have birch. There's a lot of birch on the land anyway. And willow. We planted willow as well in some of the wet areas. Hazel, Scots pine, alder, which is another water-loving tree, and crabapple. And then this winter we want to get a few more more of a mix in as well, and get rowan and cherry and some of those. Again, these would be trees that nobody would grow for money, because there's no money in them, but they are beautiful. And
cherry trees
are gorgeous and have so much for insects and birds, and and will look amazing again at this time of the year when they're changing colour. They are just spectacular. So you know, that's part of it. It's hopefully going to be a beautiful landscape as well as a home for many, many, many millions of creatures.
And then back to the climate issues in terms of carbon and what's that? How's that changing that place that's down there, and what it's doing for all of us, for the environment? What has been the change?
I think it's been, I mean, it's a very early stage now, but the trees are growing. You can see how they're just in their element. You know, there's the conditions that we're facing, you know, these very heavy downpours, these very warm summers, but wet, are perfect growing conditions for trees. So yeah, I mean, it's the place is beginning to feel like somewhere that's starting again. For a long time, and you know, I'd go down on the train and be there trying to figure it out. It felt like a place where everything had come to an end, and now there's a whole new thing starting there, and that's pretty exciting.
You wrote in your piece, depending on how the trees grow and how the soil life grows with them, our 11 hectares could remove 120 tonnes of carbon a year. Mm-hmm. So that's must be very satisfying.
Yeah, and it I mean, it sounds like a lot. And then you look at our carbon, you know, our average carbon footprint is 12 tons a year per person. So that's 10 people in a year.
Okay, yeah. So it does kind of reduce it a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
120 tons of carbon sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And then,
so, yeah, I haven't fixed everything, everybody.
Right, that's terrible, Catherine. I thought you'd have fixed everything by now. Jesus.
We still need to reduce our carbon emissions. Yeah, and I mean, that's the tree offset thing is increasingly looking like a bad idea, because, you know, we don't have enough land. We still need to feed ourselves. We don't have enough land to offset the growing emissions with forests. We need to cut our emissions and grow the forests and protect the forests that are already existing. But it can be part of it. I mean, land use, this is where farmers can be the heroes in the next stage of this. Our land use is our biggest resource for drawing down carbon out of the atmosphere, and we can still farm and we can still produce food, but we have to do it in ways that are, you know, becoming carbon and nature positive.
The government gets a lot of criticism for a lot of things, but they are pumping 1.3 billion euro into a new forestry program, and that's all about people like you planting more trees, and maybe not like you, but people who are in that, who own land. So what does it mean? I mean, is it good news for you, but also for other people who might be thinking of doing this?
Yeah, hopefully it's going to be good news. You know, the grants are extremely generous now. There's still, if you're interested in making money from the system, probably Sitka Crop is the one that you're going to go for. But as I say, that is also comes with much more broadleaves planted as part of the mix. So it's not as monoculture as it was. And there are ways that can be managed that aren't as environmentally damaging. But I think the interesting thing about all of this new money coming into forestry is that it's a great career opportunity for people. It's almost entirely male at the moment. So I think more women in forestry would be amazing. I was down with a woman in Mullingar, near Mullingar, called Olive Levy, and she's managing a forest that her dad planted as his pension. She's just, she's an amazing woman with a chainsaw. You know, she's really excited by that idea of continuous cover forestry, which is such an interesting...
Forester Barbie.
Definitely.
Job is tree.
Yeah, her job is tree, her job is wood, her job is timber. Her job is biodiversity, carbon. I mean, there's so many interesting and satisfying careers in this, in urban forestry. You know, we're going to have to get forests into cities, into parks, back to the pocket forest idea. When we work with kids, especially, you know, in schools where they have a lot of struggles, one kid said to us, you know, I found my life's calling, you know.
And that's, God, Catherine.
And I think so many people feel like that about this work, that we're really excited about being able to give people work, hopefully, in the future in it.
It was lovely when your article was published. I think the response was, I mean, people get criticised so much these days for even doing lovely things, but it was just a warm hug, I think, came to you. People were so grateful and inspired and loved what you'd written. And I think it's because it wasn't preachy at all, because sometimes we feel a little bit like guilt. Well, we feel a lot guilty that maybe we're not doing as much. But reading your piece, it just felt very like, oh God, there's one person just trying to make a difference, and it's possible. So to anybody listening who might be similarly inspired, like, what would you say? Maybe not everyone can go off and buy land in Roscommon or anywhere else, but what can people do?
Well, there's all kinds of ways that you can, you know, there are lovely organisations, the Native Woodland Trust do open days, and you can go down and plant trees. The Home Tree do open days as well, where you can also get involved. But it's also possible to pool resources and buy, you know, it doesn't have to be 40 acres. It could be 5 acres. It's better than nothing.
With a few friends, maybe, or family.
Absolutely. Or talk to family. I mean, we're not that disconnected from people who own land. Talk to family members who have a field that they're not doing anything with, and say, have you heard about this Native Woodland scheme? You know, it might be, it's a wonderful way to, as I say, give a piece of land that maybe is just very unloved a whole new lease of life. And it's not a lot of work to manage it. You know, you can employ people. I think a lot of the older farmers would feel, you know, I don't want to have to learn how to use a chainsaw, but you don't have to. There are lots of young people who can come along and help manage the forest. So I think there are many ways to do it, and many ways to be a part of it. Hopefully, there's an organisation called Nature Trust who are doing something similar to what we're doing. And they're hoping in 10 or 15 years to be able to open up those forests as amenities so people can go and visit them, can go walking and sit in them. And there'll be all of this information there for them as about what's planted and when it was planted and why. So a little bit like, I mean, the one thing that the Millennium Forest Project, I think, fell down on was we all felt really excited about having a Millennium Forest in our name, but we didn't really have a place where we could go and visit those trees. And, you know, I think a lot of them were probably lost to deer, and you know there was great intentions, but not a lot of resources behind it. Whereas now, I think there's more of a hunger for people to say, "I would like to." Our native woodlands they're only about 2% of the country. You know, it's a tiny scrap of fragments of native woodlands. So if we can re-establish them and make them public amenities, we can share them with people. I mean, that's our hope for what we're doing in Roscommon, that we can share it and make it open to people to come and visit as much as possible and learn from it as we're learning from it. And as I think we'll never stop learning from it. So that's, and I think that's why the great reaction came to the piece, because somebody said it gave them hope, you know, and I get that. I get hope from working with trees and soil, because I can see the absolute health and vigor and life force of things that, you know, when you're in the flow with this, it's fixing itself. You take one good step and nature takes 10. And that's the hope that I wanted to communicate to people. And yeah, I got the best emails from people, including the funniest one from somebody who said he hoped he lived long enough to see a chuffing spackle spot, which was my made up name for a bird, because I'm not very good on identifying birds.
Chuffing spackle spot was excellent. Great one. Now, Catherine, meanwhile, Pocket Forest is still going from strength to strength. So mm-hmm. we thought we could do a little live consultation. Suzanne, when we were talking, Suzanne, who produces the podcast with me, we were talking earlier about what could you do. And she has a bit of land in front of her house. It's uh-huh. paved over. Uh-huh. So Suzanne, come over here and tell Catherine about the bit of land you have that's paved over that you might like to get a few trees on and how she can help.
Yeah, so Roisin's saying it sounds like a bit of land, but I mean it's the space of where you'd fit a car.
An acre.
So yes, no, it's I never think of it as land or frontage.
But it is land. You've done well, Suzanne. It is frontage.
Now we had two cars and we made the decision to sell the car that was just, you know, catching cobwebs and sitting there gathering leaves from the trees above. So it's paved and it's just dead space in front of the house. So my dream would to be fill it with trees and flowers and just have this really lush part of the garden. But I don't actually know where to start.
Is so it a Kango hammer? Can you get your hands on a Kango hammer? I've never used one, but I've seen them used. And yeah, so it depends on the paving. Is it liftable or do you have to Kango it?
It's solid? Kind of cobbly, I think.
Yeah, you could definitely remove it and there will be soil under it. And the car parking space is our Pocket Forest's smallest size. So we fit 12 trees and shrubs into that space, planted super closely.
And actually, that's one of the questions is when you think of planting a forest in front of your house, you're thinking, are the trees going to grow really high and block all the light and everything? Like, is there a way that you can do it that you're minimizing the height of it so it's not reaching up to the bedroom? Or
definitely. I mean, that's the thing about, we plant them when they're 2-year-old whips, so they're knee high. Okay. And by, you know, second growing season, they're 2 meter high, and then at that point you just begin to top them and say, this is how high you're going to get. So it's a little bonsai forest, basically. Yeah. It's not a forest, but it's a version, a specimen of it. And you'll still get all the birds, you'll still have all the insects on those trees, you'll still have the flowers and fruits that they produce. But you're managing it for size because, you know, you don't want to have...
And do many people do it in their front gardens? Because feel like, you know, when I walk along the road, it's all, you just see the hydrangeas, don't you? Like, that's as far as everyone goes with their gardening. But
not enough people do it. I think there's huge potential for those front garden spaces where, again, it gives you that sense when you come to your house of you're arriving into this place with trees and shrubs outside. They don't take, I mean, there's far less maintenance than a lawn. You're not mowing it. You're just doing a little bit of light pruning in the wintertime. It depends on what you plant. So things like elders and dog roses might need a bit of, you know, pruning every few weeks in the summertime and growing time. But again, it's really satisfying and you've made it yourself and you're watching it and you're seeing all the birds coming and all the insects and the soil life is you know, just making amazing connections under the ground as well. That's why they're so closely planted. So, yeah, I'd love to see. I mean, we'd love to see pocket forests in every front garden.
So, Catherine, can you come and help Suzanne to do that then?
I would love to, yeah. I'd love to do that.
That would be amazing. Yeah. What are you doing now?
Let me get my Kango hammer.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Suzanne. And Catherine, it's been absolutely amazing talking to you. And I would really urge everyone to read that piece if they haven't already. We have a thing called Dwell Time where we monitor how long people spend on an article, and it was incredible, the dwell time on that one. I think people were just at the weekend just reveled in it and loved reading your words, and as you said, it gave people hope and made people feel that there is positive stuff that we can do and that people are doing. So just final word from you about, like, just to encourage other people maybe to look at their own spaces and other their relative spaces.
Absolutely. You know, there's so many good projects happening. There are people, Government Ninail does this wonderful little mini pond as well. So you can put a mini pond into your garden. It doesn't have to be a full pocket forest. It could just be one native tree and two shrubs. But, you know, make it a little bit more than one tree, because those lone trees are very lonely. they do need company. And yeah, you won't believe, we had a nursery guy say to us, people don't know they want a wild garden until they have one. And then they realise, I love this. And they talk to their neighbours about it. And it becomes a kind of a halo effect as well. And we just see things differently. And we have to begin to do that.
Gorgeous. Thank you so much, Catherine Cleary. And come back again and tell us when it's even more wildy.
Yeah,
and
you have to
when
come
you're
down.
Welcome. I will.
An outside broadcast.
Definitely, I'll get me tent. I hope it's not raining. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks, Josie.
That was Catherine Cleary there, and isn't she just fantastic? Doesn't it make you want to just run out and plant a tree? Well, go to pocketforests.ie for more information. And if Suzanne does get it together to do that front garden of shrubs and trees, we'll come back and let you know all about it. If you enjoyed the episode and the podcast, please leave us a review or subscribe to the podcast, as it really makes a difference to us. The podcast is produced by Suzanne Brennan and by me, Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. Talk to us on social at IT Women's Podcast, or email us on the Women's Podcast at irishtimes.com. That's it from me. Mind yourselves, and I'll talk to you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.